Confronting Islamist extremism has been a big focus of America's foreign policy since the Cold War. Not often, though, do we get a personal glimpse inside what leads someone to turn to extremist Islamism.
Our next guest grew up in England, surrounded by American pop culture. However, he became an activist for Muslim extremism and found himself imprisoned in Egypt. While he was in prison, he reevaluated his beliefs, and when he left, he became the co-founder of a counter-extremism think tank.
Majid Nawaz shares his experience in his recently published memoir, Radical: My Journey Out of Islamist Extremism. Majid joins us now from the UK. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So we throw around terms like Islamist and extremism a lot. What do you mean by Islamist extremism?
So Islamism, defined briefly in one sentence, is basically the desire to impose any given interpretation of Islam over society by law. That's different to Islam as a faith. I have absolutely no issue with any Muslim practicing any interpretation of their religion in their own lives. What I challenge, and the views I used to subscribe to, I describe now as Islamism, and that, as I said, is the desire for the imposition of one's interpretation of Islam over society by law.
In your introduction to your American edition of the book, you say if there's one group in the world that's misunderstood as Muslims, it's Americans. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Absolutely. I mean, look, in Muslim-majority countries, whether it's in South Asia or across the Middle East, or even in Europe, in fact, which aren't Muslim-majority countries, America is so misunderstood. There's a level of phobia, and there's a lose-lose scenario for America. Let's take foreign policy, and let's take Syria as a case study. The narrative that there's a global war led by America against Islam and Muslims applied to Syria is spun by Islamists as if America had intervened, it would have been seen as another example of this global war against Islam and Muslims, because it would have been spun to say that America only intervened because it feared the rise of the Islamist opposition and wanted to curtail them. If America doesn't intervene, which it hasn't, it's spun and portrayed as, oh, look, Americans don't care about Muslim lives and Muslims being killed in Syria. And this sort of anti-Americanism has taken hold across the Middle East and in South Asia. And in Europe, it's mainly a far-left narrative. The far-left, for their own ideological dogmatic reasons, are opposed to global capitalism, and they see America as the head of global capitalism. And in many instances, people will be surprised, but it's what's happening. It's what I describe in my book. The far-left and what I call the regressive aspects of the left movement have jumped in bed with the Islamists and have found common foe in America and have allied instead with each other, which is absurd when you think about the origins of the left movement and how they should be opposed to the politicization of religion. But in this instance, they'd rather just challenge America instead.
Let's turn to your story now. You were a recruiter for a group that shared that belief about America, not an Al-Qaeda-linked group. What led you, a young guy in the UK listening to American hip-hop music, to join a group like that?
Yeah, so as you said, I was born and raised in the UK, and grew up on hip-hop and came from a very integrated background. But in my teenage years, I experienced some very serious and severe violent racism from an organized group of neo-Nazi thugs who were targeting me because of the color of my skin. And that began my disillusionment. That began the process of my disillusionment and disenfranchisement from society. That coupled with the genocide in Bosnia against white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed Muslims led me to seek alternative solutions to what I saw as the world order having failed to stop or prevent that genocide. Already not having much trust in the establishment in the UK, having perceived them as having let me down in the racist violence that I faced, I began seeking for alternative forms of expression. And at that vulnerable age of around 15 years old, I came across an Islamist recruiter who sold to me this narrative that, in fact, Bosnia is part of the global war against Islam and Muslims, and to truly defend both yourself in Britain against racist attack, but also Bosnian Muslims against the genocide there, you need to create a resurrect a global Muslim superstate that he called the Caliphate. And only this global Muslim superstate would be able to protect the life and the honor and the dignity of Muslims. I subscribed to that narrative and to that ideology at the age of 16. and became an active recruiter for the group that I then joined, which is called Hizb ut-Tahrir, which, as you've correctly said, isn't the same as Al-Qaeda, but it is a revolutionary Islamist organization.
Do you think yours is a common story, a young Muslim man disillusioned with the Western world gets drawn into this this mindset?
Well, I think it's there is no one fixed route into these organizations. And so I always speak in terms of factors that play a part. What is common are these factors, and they are a combination of ideology, in this case, the Islamist ideology, charismatic recruiters, people that provide a sense of belonging where that sense of belonging doesn't exist elsewhere. That's two. Three is an identity crisis, sort of a question as to whether Muslims belong in Europe and whether we can be British Muslims or whether we're indeed outcast in these societies. And the same identity questions apply in America with all the civil rights struggles that you've had in your history. And then the fourth factor, of course, is the sense of grievance. So when those four factors, grievances, identity crises, charismatic recruiters, and ideological narratives come together, it's very easy to recruit someone.
You ended up in Egypt and in an Egyptian prison. I would assume that that would radicalize someone even more, push you further to the extreme. You had the opposite experience. Why?
Yes, ordinarily that has been the case, that people that witness torture in Egypt's jails end up becoming even more extreme and hardened in their views. And that's one of the strongest cases for why, in fact, torture doesn't produce the results we sometimes may think that it does. But in my case, more evidence for the assertion I've just made, in fact, is that Amnesty International adopted me as a prisoner of conscience. And the reason they did is because they said this guy may have extremely reprehensible views, but he hasn't participated in violence. And because of that, we believe he has he shouldn't have been detained, and he most certainly shouldn't have witnessed torture. And Amnesty started campaigning after that for my release from prison. And Amnesty's work in for me and for my release touched my heart. And what I've said in my autobiography is where the heart leads, the mind can follow. And so once my heart opened up in that way, I call it the process of rehumanization. When that began happening, I began studying, debating, and discussing with the other prisoners I was with, the other political prisoners, and my mind began to change. It is important to mention that I joined this group at 16, and I was imprisoned at 24. So I was still very young. I'm now 36 years old. I left prison at 28. And so as well as sort of this, let's say, analytical explanation I've just given you, there is an easier way to say it, and that's that I just grew up.
You are back in the UK now. You're going to be running for a seat, I gather, in the House of Commons for the Liberal Democratic Party. What do you think politicians in the West can do to improve relations between the US, the UK, and those who see Western culture as a threat?
Yes, you're correct. I am now a Liberal Democrat parliamentary candidate standing in the 2015 general election. I'd be the first Bush-era war on terror political prisoner to successfully be selected and to run in a democracy anywhere. And also, if I were to be elected, I'd be the first parliamentarian in Britain to speak fluent Arabic in the House of Commons. I think that that in itself, in answer to your question, can do a lot, because currently, if we're formulating policy, and yes, many of the civil servants in the UK have language expertise, but if the people making the laws and if the people representing this country in trips abroad as ministers or on high levels aren't able to understand the complexity of the cultures in the Middle East, and in particular, one of the themes I draw out in my book, in particular, key to understanding the Middle East is to know that Islamism isn't, in fact, representative of Muslims in the Middle East and South Asia, but is a modern dogmatic ideological phenomenon that arose influenced by post-World War I European ideas relatively recently in the Middle East. So in understanding all of these complexities, when negotiating our country's foreign policy, I think we would stand far better informed and in a far stronger position if we had people in Parliament that had that intimate experience and understanding with the Middle East.
Briefly, do you have a message for maybe the average American about understanding the Muslim world?
I'd say read my book, Radical, published by Majid Nawaz Lions Press.
All right, that was brief. Majid, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Majid Nawaz. Again, the book is Radical, My Journey Out of Islamist Extremism, and his organization is Quilliam. It's a counter-extremism think tank.